The next day, as the wagon train rolled northwards, they saw at a distance the herds of wild antelope parting like the bow wave of an ocean-going vessel. Jim recognized that this was how animals reacted to the presence of human beings. He had no way of knowing what lay ahead, so he ordered Small Boy to form the wagons into a defensive square and issue a musket to each man. Then, taking Bakat and Zama with them, he and Louisa rode out to scout the land ahead. The grassy plain undulated like the swells of the ocean, and when they reached the next crest of higher ground and could see ahead, they reined in spontaneously and stared in silence at the strange sight that was revealed to them. Tiny with distance, a column of forlorn human figures toiled across the plain, moving so painfully slowly that they raised almost no dust. They had no domestic animals with them, and as they drew closer, Jim could see through the telescope that they were carrying their meagre possessions on their heads, clay pots and calabashes, or bundles wrapped in animal skins. There was nothing hostile in their appearance, and Jim rode to meet them. As the distance narrowed, more details became apparent. The straggling file was made up almost entirely of women and their children. The infants were being carried in leather pouches slung on the backs or across the hips of their mothers. They were all wasted and thin, with legs like dried sticks. They walked with the slack, dragging gait of exhaustion. As Jim and Louisa watched, one of the skeletal women sagged to the ground. The bundle and the two small children she carried on her back were too great a burden. Her companion stopped to help her back to her feet. One held a water gourd to her mouth to allow her to drink. It was a touching gesture.
"These people are dying on their feet," Louisa said softly.
As they rode closer, she counted their heads.
"There are 68 of them, but I may have missed some of the children."
When they were within hail of the head of the sorry file, they stopped the horses and Jim rose in the stirrups. "Who are you, and where do you come from?" It seemed that they were so far gone they had not seen the party until then, for Jim's voice caused confusion and despair among them. Many of the women threw down their bundles and seized their children. They scattered back the way they had come, but their efforts at escape were pathetic, and one after another they staggered to a halt and collapsed in the grass, unable to run further. They tried to escape attention by lying flat and pulling their leather capes over their heads. Only one had not run, an old man. He, too, was stick-thin and frail, but he straightened and stood with dignity. He let the shawl drop from his shoulders, let out a shrill, quavering war cry, and charged straight at Jim, brandishing a throwing spear. From 50 paces, out of range of his old arm, he hurled the spear, which pegged into the earth halfway between him and Jim. Then he sagged to his knees. Jim rode warily closer, alert for another warlike attack from the silver-headed ancient. "Who are you, old father?" he repeated. He had to ask the same question in three different dialects before the man started with recognition and answered,
"I know who you are, you who ride upon the back of wild animals and speak in tongues. I know you are one of the white crocodile wizards that come out of the great waters to devour men. How else would you know the language of my people? Yet I fear you not, foul demon, for I am old and ready to die. But I will die fighting against you who devour my daughters and my grandchildren."
He staggered to his feet and drew the axe from his belt.
"Come, and we will see if you have blood in your veins like other men."
The dialect he spoke was of the northern Lhotse, which old Abuli had taught Jim. "You terrify me, bold warrior," he told the old man gravely. "But let us put aside our weapons and talk for a while before we do battle."
"He looks confused and terrified," Louisa said, "the poor old man."
"It may be that he is not accustomed to discourse with wizards and demons," Bakat remarked dryly. "But one thing I know. If he is not fed soon, the wind will blow him away." The old man was swaying on his bony legs. "When did you last eat, great chieftain?" Jim asked.
"I do not parley with wizards or crocodile spirits," announced the old man with disdain.
"If you are not hungry, then tell me, chieftain, when did your daughters and your grandchildren last eat?" The old man's defiance wavered.
He looked back at his people, and his voice was low as he replied with simple dignity, "They are starving."
"I can see that," Jim said grimly.
"Jim, we must fetch food for them from the wagons," Louisa burst out.
"It'll need more than our few fishes and loaves to feed this multitude. Then when they have eaten our pantry bare, we will starve with them," Jim answered, and turned in the saddle to survey the herds of game that were scattered across the plains in every direction.
"They are starving in the midst of plenty. Their hunting skills and crude weapons will not bring down a single head of game from all this multitude," he said, then looked back at the old man. "I will use my witchcraft not to destroy your people, but to feed them."
They left him standing and rode out across the plain. Jim picked out a herd of cow-like wildebeest, strange-looking creatures with fringes of dark mane and lunate horns, their legs too thin for their robust bodies. These were the fools of the felt, and they gambled ahead of Bakut and Zama as they rode in a wide circle to surround them and drive them back towards Jim and Louisa. When the herd leaders were almost within gunshot, they sensed the danger and put down their ugly heads. Snorting and kicking up their heels, they ran in earnest. Drumfire and Trueheart came up on them easily. Riding in close and shooting from the saddle, Jim dropped a beast with a shot from each of his guns, and Louisa brought down another with the little French rifle. They roped the carcasses by the heels and dragged them behind the horses to where the old man was squatting in the grass. He rose to his feet. When he realized what they had brought him, he cried out to his followers in a quavering voice, "Meat! The devils have brought us meat! Come quickly and bring the children!" Timidly, one old woman crept forward while the others hung back. The two old people started work on the carcasses, using the blade of the throwing spear as a butcher's knife. When the rest of the band saw that they were not being molested by the white devils, they came swarming forward to the feast. Louisa laughed aloud to see mothers hacking off lumps of raw meat and chewing it to a pulp before spitting it into the mouths of their children, like mother birds feeding their chicks. When their first hunger was appeased, they built fires to roast and smoke the rest of the kill. Jim and Louisa hunted again, bringing in more prime game to provide enough smoked meat to feed even this number of mouths for some months. Very soon the little tribe lost all fear and became so trusting that they no longer skittered away when Louisa walked among them. They even allowed her to pick up and dandle the little ones. Then the women clustered around her, touched her hair, and stroked her pale skin with awe. Jim and Bakut sat with the old man and questioned him.
"What people are you?"
"We are of the Lhotse, but our totem is the Bakwato."
"How are you called, great chieftain of the Bakwato?" Jim asked.
"Tigwani. And in truth I am but a very small chief," he replied. "The Tigwani was the little fish-eating brown stork with a feathered topknot that frequented every stream and river pool."
"Where do you come from?"
The old man pointed to the north.
"Where are the young warriors of your tribe?"
"Slain by the Nguni," Tigwani said, "fighting to save their families. Now I am trying to find a place where the women and children will be safe, but I fear the killers are not far behind us."
"Tell me about these Nguni," Jim invited. "I have heard the name spoken with fear and awe, but I have never seen them, nor met any man who has."
"They are killer devils," Tigwani replied. "They come swiftly as cloud shadows the plain, and they slaughter every living soul in their path."
"Tell me all you know of them. What do they look like?"
"Eh, the warriors are big men built like ironwood trees. They wear black vulture feathers in their headdress. They have rattles on their wrists and ankles, so their legions make the sound of the wind when they come."
"What of their weapons?"
"They carry black shields of dried oxhide, and they scorn the throwing spear. They like to come close with the short, stabbing assegai. The wound from that blade is so wide and deep that it sucks the blood from the victim like a river as they pluck out the steel."
"Where do they come from?"
"Oh, no man knows. But some say from a land far to the north. They travel with great herds of plundered cattle, and they send their cohorts ahead to slaughter all in their path."
Who is their king?
They have no king, but a queen. Her name is Manatasi. I have never seen her, but they say she is crueler and more warlike than any of her warriors.
He looked fearfully to the horizon.
I must take my people on to escape her. Her warriors cannot be far behind us now. Perhaps if we cross the river, they may not follow us.
They left Tegwani and his women working over the fires to smoke the rest of the meat and rode back to the wagons. That night, as they ate their dinner by the glow of the campfire under a canopy of glittering stars, they discussed the predicament of the little tribe of refugees. Louisa proposed to return next morning with their meagre chest of medicines and bags of flour and salt.
"If you give them all we have, what will happen to us?" Jim asked reasonably.
"Just for the children?"
she tried again, although she knew he was right, and it was a forlorn hope that he might agree.
"Child or grown, we cannot take an entire tribe under our wing. We have provided them with food sufficient to see them to the river and beyond. This is a cruel land. Like us, they have to fend for themselves or perish."
She did not come to his wagon that night, and he missed her. Although they were still as chaste as brother and sister, he had become accustomed to her presence in the night. When he woke, she was already working at the campfire. During this hiatus on the river bank, their hens had been allowed out of their coop on the back of the wagon to forage. In gratitude, they had produced half a dozen eggs. Louisa made an omelette for his breakfast and served it without a smile, making her disapproval obvious.
"I had a dream last night," she told him.
He suppressed a sigh. He was learning to make room in his life for her dreams.
"Tell me." "I dreamed that something terrible happened to our friends, the Bekwato."
"You do not yield without a fight, do you?" he asked. She only smiled at him once they were riding back towards where they had left the small group of fugitives. During the ride, he tried to think of other good reasons to dissuade her from taking on the role of benefactor and protector of the 70 starvelings, but he bided his time before he returned to the contest of wills. The drifting smoke from the fires on which the meat was curing guided them the last league. As they crested the rise, they reined in with surprise. Tekwani's encampment was not as they had last seen it. Dust mingled with the smoke of the fires to veil the scene, but many tiny figures were scurrying in and out of the low cloud. Jim pulled his telescope out of its case. After one glance through the lens, he exclaimed, "Sweet Jesus! The Nguni have found them already!"
"I knew it," Louisa cried. "I told you something terrible had happened, didn't I?"
She spurred forward, and he had to ride hard to catch her. He grabbed Trueheart's rein and brought them to a halt.
"Wait! We must have a care. We don't know what we're riding into. They are killing our friends.
The old man and his tribe are probably dead already, and we do not want to join them." Quickly he explained to Bakat and Zama what he planned. Fortunately, the wagons were not far behind them. He gave orders to Zama to ride back and warn Small Boy and his men to stand on guard and to bring all the oxen, spare horses and other animals into the centre of the laager. "When they've secured the camp, bring Small Boy and two of the other drivers back here fast as you like. Bring two muskets for each man. Fill the bullet bags with goose shot and bring extra powder flasks." The smooth bores were quicker to reload than the rifles. A handful of goose shot fired at close range would spread widely and might bring down more than one enemy with each discharge. Although Louisa fretted and argued to go immediately to the rescue of the little band of refugees, he made her wait until Zama brought up the reinforcements of men and weapons.
"They will be here within the hour," he assured her.
"By then the Bakwato will all be wiped out."
She wanted to take the telescope from his hand, but he would not give it to her.
"It's better that you do not watch this."
Through the lens he could see the sparkle of steel blades in the sunlight, waving war shields and dancing feathered headdresses. Even his flesh crawled with horror as he saw a naked Bakwato woman run out of the dust clouds, clutching an infant to her breast. She was pursued by a tall plumed warrior. He came up behind her and stabbed her in the back. The point of the assegai came out between her breasts. Jim saw the steel flash pink with her blood, like the shine of a salmon's flank turning below the surface. She fell forward into the grass. The warrior stooped over her, then straightened up with her infant dangling from one hand. He threw the child high into the air, and as it fell, he caught it, neatly skewered on the point of the assegai. Then, brandishing the little corpse like a standard, he rushed back into the dust and smoke. At last, but not too soon for Louisa, Zama galloped back with small boy, Klaas, and Muntu, the other drivers. Swiftly, Jim checked to see that their muskets were primed and loaded. They were all well-versed in the use of the guns, but Jim had never seen their temper tested in a hard fight. He formed them into an extended line, and then, keeping the horses to a walk, to save their strength, they rode towards the embattled encampment. Jim kept Louisa close to him. He would have preferred to send her back to the safety of the wagons, but he knew better than to suggest it. As they closed, they could hear the outcry coming from the encampment, the screams and the wailing, the wild, triumphant ululations of the Nguni as they plied the assegai and the kerry. Under the cloud of dust and smoke, the grassland was littered with the broken bodies of the dead women and children, like flotsam thrown on a storm-swept beach. "They are all killed," Jim thought, and his anger became murderous. He glanced across at Louisa. Her face was blanched with horror as she looked upon the carnage. Then, incredibly, he saw that one, at least, of the Bakwatu was still alive. In the centre of the encampment there was a low outcrop of granite. It formed a natural strong point, a zariba walled with rock. Here stood the gaunt figure of Tegwani, a club in one hand and a spear in the other. His body was painted with his own blood and that of his enemies. He was surrounded by Nguni warriors. They seemed to be toying with the old man, amused by his courage. Cats with a doomed mouse, they danced about him, mocking him and laughing at his warlike antics. Tegwani had regained a little of the strength and ferocity of his lost youth. His shrill war cry and his shouts of defiance rang out, and Jim saw one of his attackers stagger back from a spear thrust into his face. He clutched the wound, and blood spurted out between his fingers. This success sealed Tegwani's fate, and the Nguni moved in with purpose. By now the thin line of horsemen was within 100 paces of the periphery of the camp, so immersed were the Nguni in the joy of killing that none was aware as yet of their approach. "How many of them are there?" Jim called to Louisa. "I see not more than 20 or so," she answered. "A small scouting party," Jim guessed. Then he shouted to his men, "Have at them! Take them! Shoot them down like rabid jackals!" They pushed the horses into a canter and charged down on the camp. Just ahead of the line, an Nguni was prodding one of the younger women with his assegai, goading her into a position for a thrust to her belly. But she was rolling and writhing on the ground like an eel, avoiding the bright steel point. He was so preoccupied with his cruel game that Louisa was almost on him before he looked up. Jim was not sure what she intended, but it took him by surprise when she raised the musket and fired. The charge of goose shot slammed into the Nguni's sweat-glazed chest, and he was flung backwards by the force of it. Louisa pulled the second musket from its sheath and kept her station at Jim's side as they charged the knot of warriors that surrounded Tegwani. She fired again, and another man dropped. Even in the exigency of the moment, Jim felt awed by her ruthlessness. This was not the girl he had thought he knew. She had just killed 2 men, coldly and efficiently, allowing none of the emotions that raged within her to show. The warriors attacking Tegwani heard the gunfire behind them. The heavy reports were sounds alien to them, and when they turned to face the line of horsemen, their astonishment and bewilderment showed clearly on their faces, which were speckled with the blood of their victims. Jim fired only seconds after Louisa. The heavy lead goose shot tore into one naked belly, felling the man instantly, and shattered the arm of the warrior beside him. His assegai dropped from his grip, and the arm hung uselessly at his side, half severed above the elbow. The wounded man looked down at his dangling arm, then reached down and picked up his fallen assegai with his left hand, and ran straight at Jim, who was astonished by his courage. Both his muskets were empty, and he was forced to draw the pistol from the holster on the front of his saddle. The ball hit the charging Nguni full in the throat. He made a gargling noise, and blood sprayed from his severed windpipe, but his example was an inspiration to his comrades. They recovered from their surprise, left Tegwani, and launched themselves at the horsemen, keening with eagerness, their faces alight with bloodlust, the rattles at their ankles buzzing with every stamp of their bare feet and thrust of their stabbing arms. Zama and Bakat fired together, and each killed one. Two more were struck by the volley from Smallboy and the other drivers, but their aim was wild, and even the wounded Nguni came on strongly, almost closing within range of their short assegais. "Back! Back to reload!" Jim shouted. The line of horsemen broke and wheeled away, galloping out of the encampment. The charge of the Nguni faltered and halted when they could not overtake the horses. Well out in the veldt, Jim stopped his men and brought them under control again. "Dismount and reload," he ordered. "Keep your mounts on the rein. You don't want to lose them now." They obeyed with alacrity. With the reins secured round their shoulders, they poured powder and shot into the muzzles and rodded a handful of goose shot down on top. "Smallboy and his lads may shoot like rabbits," Jim muttered to Louisa, as he primed the pan of his second musket, "but at least they're still under control." Louisa worked almost as quickly and neatly as he did, and she finished loading both her weapons only a little after him. The Nguni were encouraged to see them halted. With savage shouts, they broke into a run again, swiftly covering the open grassland towards the group of dismounted riders. "At least we have drawn them away from their victims," Louisa said as she stepped into the saddle. Jim went up on drumfire, but the rest of the men were still busy reloading. Jim saw that Louisa was right. All of the remaining enemy warriors had joined in the chase and were streaming towards them across the grassland. At the granite outcrop, old Tegwani stood alone, obviously badly hurt but still alive. Bakat finished priming the pan of his musket and, with the agility of a monkey, leapt into the saddle. He fell in beside Jim, but the others were still busy. "Follow us when you're loaded," Jim shouted, "but hurry." Then to Louisa and Bakat, "Come on! We'll give them a whiff of gun smoke to blunt their appetite." The three trotted out to meet the advancing band of warriors. "They show no fear," Louisa said with reluctant admiration, as the Nguni bayed like a pack of hunting dogs and burst into a headlong charge straight at them. When only 100 paces separated them, Jim halted. From the saddle they fired deliberately. Two of the attackers collapsed, a third fell to his knees and clutched his belly. They changed muskets and fired again. Both Jim and Bakat brought down another man each, but the strain was telling on Louisa. The muskets were far too heavy for her, and she flinched instinctively at the painful recoil. Her second shot flew high. The other Nguni closed in, howling savagely. Only a few were still on their feet, but their faces were lit with battle fever, and they held their black war shields high. "Back!" Jim ordered, and they turned away, almost under the shadow of the shields, and galloped towards where Zama, Smallboy, and the rest of the company were at last reloaded and mounting. As they passed each other, Jim shouted across at Smallboy, "Don't let them get too close. Stand off and shoot them down. We'll reload and come after you." While Jim's party reloaded, he saw that Smallboy was obeying his orders. He and his men were keeping their horses just ahead of the charge of the Nguni, baiting them on, stopping to fire when they were in killing range, then spurring ahead again. They were doing better now. Two more of the warriors were lying lifeless in the grass. When their muskets were empty, Smallboy broke off his attack and led his men back. By this time, Jim's party had reloaded and were in the saddle again. The ranks of horsemen passed through each other as one retreated and the other went forward. "Pretty shooting," Jim encouraged Smallboy. "Now it's our turn." The Nguni warriors saw them coming and stopped. For a moment they stood in a small, uncertain group. By now they had realized the futility of charging to meet these strangers, mounted on the back of fleet alien animals, whose speed no man on foot could match. They had swiftly learned the menace of the weapons that boomed out smoke and struck men down from afar with the force of witchcraft. One broke away and fled. However, Jim noted that he did not discard his shield and assegai. It was clear he meant not to yield, but to fight again. His companions seemed infected by his example. They turned and ran. "Steady," Jim cautioned his own men. "Don't let them draw you in."
Tegwani had warned him that it was a favoured tactic of the Nguni to pretend flight or even to feign death to lure their enemy on. One of them, the slowest runner, had fallen far behind the others. Jim went after him and caught him up swiftly. As he raised the musket, the warrior turned at bay. Jim saw that he was no stripling. There were silver strands in his short, curling beard, and he wore a headdress of ostrich feathers and the cowtails of honour and courage around his spear arm. He displayed a sudden burst of speed and darted towards Jim. He might have driven his assegai blade into Drumfire's flank, but Jim hit him full in the face with a load of goose shot. When he looked round, he saw that Louisa had obeyed his order. She had not taken up the pursuit, and Bakat and Zama had also turned back. Jim was pleased with this show of discipline and good sense. It might have been fatal to have his small force scattered across the veldt. He rode back to where Louisa waited. As he reached her side, Jim saw from her face that her rage had vanished as swiftly as it had arisen. She was looking down at one of the dead Nguni with sadness and remorse in her eyes. "We've driven them off, but they'll return, I'm sure of that," Jim told her. And she watched the distant figures of the surviving Nguni dwindle into the golden grassland and disappear at last over the fold of the ground. "It was enough," she said. "I'm glad you let them go." "Where did you learn to fight?" he asked. "If you had spent a year on the gun deck of the Mew, you would understand." At that moment, Small Boy and the other drivers rode up with their muskets recharged. "We will follow them, Samoya!" he cried eagerly. It was clear that he was still gripped by the ecstasy of battle. "No, leave them," Jim ordered sharply. "Manatasi and all her army are probably waiting for you over the next hill. Your place is back at the wagons. Go there now, protect the cattle, and make ready to meet another attack." While Small Boy and the drivers rode off, Jim led the others back to the grizzly encampment. Old Tegwani was sitting on a lump of granite, nursing his injuries and crooning a soft lament for his family and the other women and children of his tribe, whose corpses were scattered around him. While Louisa gave him water from her flask, then washed his wounds and bound them up to staunch the bleeding, Jim went through the encampment. He approached the bodies of the fallen Nguni warily, loaded pistol at the ready, but all of them were dead. The goose shot had inflicted terrible wounds. They were mostly big, handsome men, young and powerfully built. Their weapons were the work of skilled blacksmiths. Jim picked up one of the assegais. It had a marvellous balance in his hand, and both edges were sharp enough to shave the hair from his forearm. The dead warriors all wore necklaces and bangles of carved ivory. Jim took one of these ornaments from the neck of the Nguni elder he had killed with his last shot. By the ostrich feathers in his headdress and the white cowtails round his upper arms, Jim judged that he must have been senior in the band. The ivory necklace was beautifully carved, tiny human figures threaded onto a leather thong. "Each figure represents a man he's killed in battle," Jim guessed. It was obvious that the Nguni placed a high value on ivory. This intrigued Jim, and he slipped the necklace into his pocket. As he went on through the camp, he found that the Nguni had done their gruesome work thoroughly. The children had all been dispatched with merciless efficiency. For most, a single blow with a war club was all it had taken. Apart from Tegwani, they found only one other Bakwato still alive, the girl Louisa had saved with her first shot. She had a deep spear wound in her shoulder, but she was able to walk when Zama lifted her to her feet. Louisa saw that she was too young to have given birth to her first child, for her belly was flat and smooth, her breasts like unripe fruit. Tegwani let out a joyous cry when he saw she was still alive, and hobbled to embrace her.
"This is Itepi, the lily of my heart, my granddaughter," he cried.
Louisa had noticed her at their first meeting with the tribe, for she was the prettiest of all the women. Intepi came to her trustingly and sat patiently as Louisa washed and dressed her wound. When Louisa had finished tending Tekwani and his granddaughter, she looked around at the dead who lay half hidden in the grass.
"What must we do with all these others?" she called to Jim.
"We have finished here," Jim replied, then glanced up at the cloudless sky where high above the vultures were gathering.
We will leave the rest of the work to them. Now we must hurry back to the wagons. We have much to do there before the Nguni return.